Hello, Greenhorns. It is Thursday once again, and it is once again time for Greenhorns Radio, radio by young farmers, for young farmers, from young farmers all around the country, beamed straight to you through the computer or the radio waves, as it may be. And today I'm coming to you with Greenhorn Radio. My name is Severin. I'm your host. And I'm joined today by Megan Fenton, who's on the phone from Penang, New York. Are you there, Megan?
Yeah, how are you, Severin?
Hello, welcome to the show.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
So, Megan, today we're talking once again about the issues faced by young farmers and the many roles that we occupy in this fabulous food system. And you have a wonderful set of hats that you wear, a whole bunch of different hats. Maybe you could start with introducing where you're from and the place that you're from, and then describe how you're plugging into the food system there.
All right. Well, I live in Penang, New York, which is in the heart of the Finger Lakes in upstate New York with Peter Martins. I farm 350 acres of organic grain. We market to a multitude of different places, the major one being his parents' organic grain mill, which is right in Penang. And then we ship as far as Albany. Then we go up into Canada and even into Israel. So we have a diversified market. I'm also the agriculture agent for Yates County Cornell Cooperative Extension. So I do that 40 hours a week and then farm in my spare time. Through that, I serve on the local Farm Bureau, and I'm an avid member of Future Farmers of America.
So you are wearing a lot of hats and working a lot of hours. And what's the prognosis? What's going on in your town that gives you hope that young folks are going to succeed at entering ag and succeeding with their businesses in ag? What's the scene around there?
The scene around Yates County, where Penang is a hotbed of organic agriculture. The scene isn't dominated by young farmers, though. It's people who've been in it for 10 to 15 years. But the young farmer scene is changing. We just got some new grant money into Yates County. It's called the Yates County Agriculture Development Loan, and it's specifically for organic or sustainable agriculture for the viticulture folks, the grape folks, because we have a big grape industry. And so this has helped a lot of new young farmers get onto the scene. And as I've shared with you, we have an organic brewery that's just getting funding, and it's three young boys.
That's so exciting. Once you have the organic brewery, I think it's going to speed the whole process up a lot.
Yeah, I think it'll be great. I think, you know, there's so much organic agriculture going on in Yates County, but nothing to really bring it attention. I guess people don't think, corn, soybeans, and wheat is that sexy. So I think they'll be really excited by the brew, and that'll let us tell our story a little bit better.
Well, let's get back to the corn, soybeans, and wheat, and different grains and barley and spelt. Will you explain a little bit what it's like to be a grain farmer? For many of our listeners and many of the young people getting into agriculture are more vegetable-oriented or more meat animal-oriented, and grains, you know, it's good to be a second generation. It's grains because of all that equipment. So maybe you could explain a little bit what that process looks like and when you guys are starting to plant.
Yeah, so grains is a completely different scene. Like I said, we farm 350 acres. I have a full-time job on top of that, and Peter, who helps me farm, he also has a full-time job on top of that, working 40 to 50 hours for his parents' farm. And so the idea that with just our spare time in the evenings and on the weekend that we can farm 350 acres is a vast difference from vegetable farming, which is much more labor-intensive. We've also been able to make investments into larger pieces of equipment that allow us to be pretty efficient. With the grains, where we're going all year, we've actually just got our first crop already planted. We got that planted the first week of April, so we start with oats. We have oats, soybeans, wheat, corn, open pollinated corn, spelt. We look into a lot of that gluten-free market with things like emmer, triticale. So there's a diverse set of crops that we can really choose from. But we're doing everything on a much larger scale than some of the smaller vegetable folks.
And your farm is a brand new farm that you just founded. And will you explain what it means to start your own farm? Did you get did you go down to the county office and get yourself registered as DBA?
Yeah, we did, actually. I'm really lucky, though, because my mom is a county clerk for Yates County, so that process is really easy for me to get my first DBA. So we're very unoriginal. All we could come up with was MP Farms for Megan and Peter. But so we're MP Farms. We have been working off of our parents' farms for the past couple years. My parents are organic grape growers. Peter's parents' farm has been organic for about 13 years. They are Mary Howell and Claus Martins. So we both had this great infrastructure and support center from our parents starting up. So that's allowed us to share some equipment with them, and we even shared their certification for the first couple years of starting. But for the past two years, we've been certified organic on our own. So we've had a great support system there.
So now the land that you're farming, that's land that you're leasing. You don't have any land of your own yet. Is that looking to change?
Yeah, we do lease all 350 acres from different landowners. And they're not contiguous. They're not all together. They're scattered all over the place. And we're always scrambling for land. There's big competition in Yates County for farmland. We have a lot of folks that moved up out of the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. So pressure for farmland is really high, and it's really competitive to actually own your own land in this area. We're hoping to buy a farm this August that's coming for sale. But to give you an idea and just the investment that we're going to be making, you know, it's going to be about $700,000 for 130 acres tillable. And so you incur a lot of the mortgage costs and the tax costs and things like that. So the reason why we've been able to buy equipment and expand at the rate we have been is because we really don't own any land. We don't have any true land expenses. We're just renting it per acre. And our average rent per acre is about $55.
So you're going to be going up if you do get a piece of land that's your own, your cost per acre is going to go way up. But you would have
a house. Like a $7,000 a month mortgage payment.
Oh, my Lord.
I know.
But now you, thankfully, have as a profession, the role of educating and doing outreach into the community about agricultural viability. So you may be exactly in the right position and with the right training networks to be able to make a thoughtful assessment of that situation. So what is the prognosis on that? Can you do that?
Right. So the farm that we're looking to buy is coming up for a public auction. So that means that we don't get to work with a real estate agent or anything, that we just get to bid, you know, with a card, flesh it up. But you have to get all the financing and everything ready to go. So we had to do a really, you know, tight business plan. Can we really afford this? Can we cash flow this? Can we come up with $7,000 a month to pay for this? And how we did that was the land that we're going to be acquiring is actually conventional. So we're going to have a three-year transition period. So when we did this business plan, we had to even market at conventional prices. But that's really how we try to do our business plan anyway, is try to make sure that when we get into a new endeavor or anything like that, we always go with the conventional prices, because organic prices are great, but one, we don't know how stable they're going to be, and two, we're really looking towards a food justice model where we want to produce organic, healthy food that everybody can afford. And if we can make it work, then hopefully we can spread that word and bring that cost down and also bring some profits up for farmers.
So let's talk a little bit about what's different from conventional grains and organic grains, and why the prices are higher, what the costs are different, and how you can close that gap.
Right. So the conventional system, you're looking, most conventional grain farmers do corn, soybeans, maybe a little alfalfa if they're a dairy, and maybe some wheat if the price is good. But most of the time you're looking at a two-crop rotation. The majority of them use genetically modified seeds, so their seed is pretty expensive because they have to pay that technology fee. And so they have the stacked genetically modified traits so that they either show the BT gene so they can fight off the Lepidopteran pests, or they can be sprayed with Roundup or glyphosate or Liberty Link or something like that. So they're looking at, they don't usually plow their ground. They plant everything no-till. Their seed costs are close to ours because organic seed is a little bit more expensive, but we can save back our own seed. Conventional farmers can't save back their own seed because of that technology agreement that they signed with companies like Monsanto. So they can't save their own seed. So an organic farmer can bring the cost of their seed down by saving their own from year to year. Then So they don't plow either. That's the next point. Conventional farmers do no-till. They just burn the ground down with Roundup and kill all the plant matter. Sometimes they'll go in and they'll chisel plow a little bit, and then they'll plant right into it. Organic farmers, we have to plow. We have to prepare a really nice seed bed. The ground has to be pretty bare so that when we use our weed control equipment like cultivators and tine weeders, that there's nothing on the ground that's going to get caught in there and rip out the plants. We also want a really good seed bed so that the seeds germinate really quickly. So those are the two big major differences. Our weed control is done mechanically. We plow. We can save back our own seed. We don't use any herbicides like they do in the conventional system. And so also when you have in this conventional system, how we talked about, they just have corn and soybeans. So our system is we have corn, soybeans, and then a small grain like wheat or spelt. And small grains are like grasses with these big root masses, so they build a lot of organic matter. And so we have a much higher organic matter in our organic systems.
And that organic matter in the soil, that gives you an advantage in what instances?
Oh, I'm a big advocate for organic matter. It's really my thing. And as an ag educator, I really try to sing this to even my conventional farmers because it'll help them out in so many aspects. So organic matter can come from a couple different sources. It can come from crop residues, like that big underground root mass or anything that we plow under from the crop that we don't use. It can come from manure. It can come from compost. And whenever you grow a crop, it's not just exporting, you know, the minerals and the nutrients. It's also exporting carbon. And that's what that organic matter is. So you'll see conventional soils that almost look gray because the organic matter component that's in your soils is usually this dark black color. And so the darker your soil is, usually the more organic matter it has. What your organic matter does is it's this really long carbon chain, and it has the ability to hold on to nutrients and onto water. And so it drives the conventional guys nuts when they drive past our fields when it's really droughty out. And so there's no water, and their corn looks like pineapples, you know, it just turns into these spiky leaves because the plant is trying to shut itself down and close a stomata so it just tightens up so it doesn't lose water. Because there's no water in the soil because there's no organic matter to hold on to the water. When you look at our nice organically managed fields, they look just fine. They're happy as can be. The corn leaves are all spread out and green, and they're not showing any signs of drought. So it's great for organic farmers, but too, in the conventional system, I try to add to these guys, put manure on your fields, put compost on your fields, grow a cover crop and plow it back in once in a while. Because even for the conventional guys, it has a lot of benefit. But it's really the basis of the system for organic.
Well, and those of us who are total nerds about sustainable agriculture are really thankful to the Rodale Institute because they did a long 10-year or even longer study comparing conventional and organic agriculture, and they found that in terms of the, you know, quantifiable results that they could get from a long-term scientific study, that the drought resistance of organically managed fields was one of the most compelling reasons that they could present to conventional farmers that when you have a higher level of organic matter in your field, that really does confer drought resistance, and that in bad years, organic will outproduce conventional just because of the organic matter.
Yeah, and so, actually this year it was such a milestone for me. I about fell off my chair when Rodale contacted Peter and I and asked us to be on the advisory board for the farming systems trial, which is what you're talking about, how they've done this comparison of conventional and organic for many years now. And so it was just great to be able to participate in that, in this, you know, really long-term research trial, and be able to give our input, and that our input was even considered worth giving was just amazing for me. So I really have to commend all the hard work that they do at Rodale. It's amazing.
Well, that's amazing that they would ask you to come and bring your insights. Will you mind reminding me and also our listeners how old you and Peter are in this business?
Yeah, I'm 23 and Peter's 21.
So I would just like to say thank you to Rodale for understanding the wisdom of the youth and including us and including Megan and Peter in that process, and to learn from them and to also let them have access to the insight that they've got from their long-time study of these issues. Okay. So
yeah, well, I have to tell one little story. When I went there, this was not that long ago, that we went down to Rodale and went at the advisory board meeting. And do you know the textbook, The Nature and Property of Soils?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the author, Ray Wheel, was sitting right at my left the whole time. And for me, an agronomy major, that was just a huge deal that I got to sit on this board with, like, the author of one of my favorite textbooks who helped build the total foundation for all my knowledge about soil science. Was just, like, a huge validation, but also just an honor, and it was amazing. So I look forward to participating with them in the future and helping them out as much as I can.
Yeah, they're really great, and we've been talking with them about doing a Young Farmer Mixer down there, and it might end up being in September. Or it might end up being later on in the season. We're still figuring it out. But they have tremendous vision. Now, one thing we didn't talk about is these wonderful tools and the equipment that I got to see when I was visiting the farm there.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind explaining the difference between, or just the technological implications of mechanical weed management?
Yeah, so one of the big bashes to organic agriculture is that we just take more trips across the field, right? And so we're just burning more fuel. Well, Peter and I really took it to heart to debunk that and wanted to make a system that minimalized the trips across the field, got effective weed control, and was just really as efficient as possible. So we make sure we do really timely weed control, but we also use some pretty big equipment. But the price gain that we've gotten from being able to sell organic commodities has allowed us to buy some of the most fuel-efficient tractors on the market. We actually run mostly what are called Fendt tractors. They're out of Germany. Most fuel-efficient on the market. We can cultivate 12 rows at a time. We have a front-mount cultivator, so it mounts on the front of the tractor on the PTO shaft, which is the power takeoff shaft. And so we can see the cultivator right out the front window, which is a big advantage over most of the guys using a six-row cultivator, which is behind them, so they have to turn and try and steer and not nook over plants. So now we're able to double the speed that we would cultivate. So now we're speeding along, cultivating just as fast as a conventional guy would be spraying. So that was a great step for us, because now we can say to conventional farmers, hey, look, you can move just as fast. It's not that much more work, because we figured out a system that's pretty efficient, and you can move pretty quickly. So we're able to cultivate really fast, and you'll hear in New York that last year was just a really bad year for weed control because it was so wet. But because we have this front-mount cultivator, we were able to cultivate all of our fields in a matter of days during those 3 days that it didn't rain over the summer. And so in times of bad weather, that we can move that quickly and get the weeds under control really minimizes our losses.
Yeah, you got to act fast. And that, my goodness, there was just not a single moment of pause that whole summer. It just rained and rained and rained. So you
guys
were okay.
So being able to cover, a couple hundred acres in the matter of 3 days, because we were able to move so fast with this equipment, you know, it saved our crop. And it brought down the price that we actually have to charge for the crop, and we're really taking just a few trips across the field because we do it timely. There are instances where organic farmers try to get out there too much and they're in their field too much, but if you do weed control in a timely manner, which is just a whole other talk, weed control in organic crops is a big issue, but we've got a really good system down where we have very clean fields and we can do it really quickly.
Now, your system's already pretty advanced. You guys are building on the experiences that you've had coming out of organic farming families.
Right.
And you really tapped into all of the resources that existed to support your growth and knowledge and understanding to get this farm started and going. Where's the project going to go next? And are you going to both keep working off the farm, as it were, for the kind of foreseeable future, or kind of what's your, like, five-year game plan?
Our five-year game plan is buy the farm. I'll keep working. We're hoping to have the mortgage. Why the mortgage payments are going to be so high is because we have a goal to pay them off within 5 years. So that's why the payments are going to be so high. We want to pay it off within 5 years. So we want to own the farm within 5 years. I would like to be full-time on the farm. Peter will be full-time on the farm within the next 2 to 3 years, hopefully. So he'll help his dad out as needed, but we should have a big enough land base that we have our hands full. We'd like to be around the 1,500 acre mark by that point. You know, Peter has big dreams of being at like 3,000 acres, but I think the 1,500 would be just fine, and then we can keep it at that family farm level.
Wow, this is a very well orchestrated thought patterns that have gone into this. I really like the confident tone that you have in saying you're going to pay off your farm in 5 years. It's wonderful.
You know, it really all comes down to the business plan. And the biggest thing I see is a lot of people do their work as a labor of love, and that's fine, and that's great, and I love what I do. But putting together a really tight business plan and aiming at the conventional price instead of the organic price as your break-even standpoint really helps you get a grasp on what you can and can't afford, and it also helps you take a step back and go, where do I need to get more efficient so that I can break even?
Mm-hmm. Now, are you taking advantage of any of the beginning farmer loans, or is this a farm start mortgage that you guys are getting, or is it completely normal, completely straight, based on market rates for conventional?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. We were at the Beginning Farmer Forum in Washington, D.C., and we were hearing from the FSA and from the Farm Start program that there are a whole bunch of loans that are designed, essentially, to help beginning farmers capitalize their businesses in the first years and buy equipment and buy land, and that those are rates that are subsidized essentially by the federal government, and they're 1.5% fixed rate type agreements. Is that the kind of deal that you guys are getting?
Yeah, we definitely depend on agencies like the Farm Service Agency and their really low loans. And that's definitely something young farmers need to really understand, learn, and seek out and approach, because you can't find interest rates that low. They have direct payment loans, and we definitely use them and are so thankful for that organization because it really helped us get that seed money to start and get going. And we also have Peter's parents who have gone through this, my parents that have gone through this, so they can kind of talk us through FSA. But really getting to know who works at your local FSA office is so crucial, because they're always on the cusp of what new grants are coming out, what new loans are available, and where you can go. So, yes, we definitely use that resource, and I don't think we could be as successful without it.
And that success that we're talking about, that's a financial success, and that's a kind of a success that is impressive, I think, to the folks who are your neighbors. I was just up there visiting, and I was very impressed by the success of Peter at the age of 21 having such a fancy truck.
Yeah, but really, I mean, that new truck is just something within the past year. You know, he had a 1984, you know, long before that, for many years, and he definitely saved up and worked on an old truck for a long time before he got something flashy and new and reliable. So,
yeah, reliable.
But you also
nice,
saw my house. I don't live in the lap of luxury by any means, you know.
No, I think, but you're making, it seems like, good and responsible decisions and thinking long term and really carefully plotting out where and when it makes sense to have the right tool for the job. And, you know, I think your success, it would be enough to impress me if I were your neighbor, and that's, I think, one of the keys to getting more and more young folks involved in sustainable ag. It's just showing.
I think probably why we're like that is because we grew up in it, and we've seen our parents take huge losses, and we've seen bad years, and we've seen years with, like, the 100-year storm that washed all the topsoil and all the crops away, and all we got was the bare-bone crop insurance payment, you know? And without a plan, it's really hard to float through those times.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you realize that there are those kinds of plans we need on a federal level. It's the weird, weird weather everyone is having right now. It makes you really
start
wondering.
It's not the funnest part of the whole thing, but it saves you in the end.
Yeah. Well, let's see now. What else do we want to talk about? Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you're doing in your other jobs and what's going on from an organizing perspective in New York State. That people might want to tune into.
So you're talking about my position with Extension?
Yeah.
So you have this really sweet deal with Cornell Cooperative Extension, which is a great research-based knowledge center for a lot of people within the agriculture community, also people who are looking for nutrition resources, 4-H, natural resources. So what I do is I'm the sustainable agriculture educator, but I'm also the land protection specialist. Half of my funding comes from a land trust. The basis of my work is what are called farmland protection grants, where we have gotten these great grants from the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets to actually purchase the development rights from farmers. So farmers can keep their land, they can keep farming it, they still own it, but they no longer have the right to sell it and put houses on it. And so what that does is it really lowers the value of the property because developers really can't approach on it ever again. It's a perpetual thing. It's a deed restriction that stays with it forever. And so what's great about it is that this protects farmland for perpetuity, forever. And so I know you're from a region that has quite a bit of a development pressure.
Yeah, I certainly am.
Yeah, so this is a great way for farmland to stay farmland. And when you're looking for local food systems and small agriculture, sustainable agriculture, local agriculture, it's really important that the population centers do still have a land base around them that can support agriculture. Because once you get that suburban crawl, it really, really encroaches on what the farmer can do. And in those lean years, like I was talking about, when you know the soil's all washed away and your crop got washed away, it's really easy for a farmer to say, "Hey, why don't I just send 10 acres into development and be able to pay off my debts and float through the next year?" But what's great about this program is Ag and Markets is giving them the money that they would usually use, to sell either by a combine or they'd sell some land to retire. But this gives them the money, but the great thing is the land still stays in agriculture. So that's a really cool thing I get to do with my job. And then I also just get to do general agriculture education outreach, so people who come to my office and want to know how to grow organic blueberries or apples or anything of that nature, or organic hops, like those great guys I was telling you about, they can call into my office and we can have a cool discussion on how to go about it.
And you just connect them with the relevant resources and figure out what books they could read or who they could talk to within Cornell Extension?
Right. So all the information that goes to them, I make sure it's research-based and that there's good founding to it, and try to give them some practical advice and resources and get them on their way and get them connected with the right people that will help them be successful in their endeavors. Because, I'd like to know everything about organic blueberries, but I really don't. But I know those great people within the Cornell community that can help them out. So I just try to facilitate farmers or, want people who want to be farmers in the right direction so they can get started.
So now, when you're just mentioning this thing about how in a hard year, when you got a lot of debt and you have a farm, you can sell off a few or 10 acres for development. Now, when you're driving around in New York or most places, you'll see that very, very frequently. You'll see the farm, the kind of home farm, and then you'll see that you can just see what chunk that got developed. And maybe it was like a sister who bought out or somebody, needed cash really quickly at one point. Now, is that a trend that is, like, did that all happen at one time historically, or is that just kind of a continuous process where farmers just keep shedding land to development? Or did that happen a lot in the 80s? That's my question.
Well, in the 80s with farm crises, it was probably more prevalent then, but I think it's been a continuous thing. I believe the American Farmland Trust says we lose a farm every 3 days to development in New York. So to give you a sense of how much we are really losing on a day-to-day basis. So I would say it's been a continued thing. I mean, I can think to my own county. So I live in the Finger Lakes, so we have these beautiful lakes surrounding us. But some of the best farmland actually surrounds these lakes. But, if we have this beautiful 100-acre piece, but if you put a house right in the center of it, it's got this beautiful lake view, it's really easy for a farmer to just say, well, chip off this corner to you and this corner to you, just to rescue them out of a bind. And actually, a lot of farmers use it for their retirement.
So it seems like if we're going to make progress on keeping this farm farming and also saving some strain on the future farmers who, can be saved from having to drive many, many, many hours to get to their to the center of town to go to the movies because of all the suburban sprawl. There needs to be more resources allocated to helping to preserve farmland.
Yeah, and New York's doing some good things now, but we all know how the budget is, and I don't know if a lot more money. Right now they have $10 million appropriated into this Farmland Protection Grant Program, where in the previous year it was at $22 million, and that was still a little bit shy. So it's at half what they had last year. And if you look to states like Pennsylvania or New Jersey, you know, they're many, many years ahead of where we are in protecting their farmland resources. So New York has a long way to go, but we're making steps in the right direction.
Well, we all have a long way to go, and we're all making steps, and I'd say that you're making many, many steps at once, and I'm thrilled to have learned of your project and made your acquaintance, and I'm thrilled to watch as your five-year plan comes true. And I look forward to learning a lot more. And people who are interested to get in touch with you or to learn more about the farm, how would they do that?
They can email me, which would be mef46@cornell.edu, or they can give me a call. I love to talk about this stuff, so it's fun for me. So 315-694-1306 is my phone number if you wanted to chat or, you know, toss some ideas around. I think that's always fun. But I also like to thank you at the same time for what you're doing with the Greenhorns. I think this is just such an essential movement to get our voice heard to all different institutions and organizations that are representing farmers, to let them know that the young farmers are real and we're here and we have a serious voice and concerns that need to be heard. And I just think it's great what you're doing.
Well, thanks, Megan, and thanks to all our listeners. Thanks to our sponsor for this session. It's Hearst Family Ranch in California. Thank you all for joining us once again. I will make a small plug to remind you of our upcoming event on next week in Oregon. We're having a social and a young farmer panel and screening of just a little teaser of the Greenhorns film, and that is at the Small Farmers Journal hosted horse-drawn farm equipment auction and swap meet. And then on April 25th, in Petaluma, California, we're having a young farmer mixer at the Baker Creek Seed Bank, which is a bank in downtown Petaluma that's been converted into a seed bank. And we'll be joined by the Green String Farm Band and others, including the Sonoma Historical Society, with a presentation about the history of the poultry industry in Petaluma. So lots and lots to know about, and please just go on our blog so you can read all about it and have enough information to show up. So we'll see you there, and thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.